You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to episode 24 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Carlton Shield, Chief Gover, and I am thrilled to have you join me on this exciting journey through the rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. For episode 24, I'm very excited. We have Dr. Madeline Mackey, also just Maddie, here on the show today. Dr. Mackey is an assistant professor of anthropology at Michigan State University in the Department of Anthropology. Maddie, thank you so much for coming on the show. You were a guest on A Life in Ruins years ago. Super excited to have you back. And real quick, could you introduce yourself for the audience?
First off, thanks for having me. As Dr. Gover said, I am Maddie Mackey. I'm an assistant professor at Michigan State, and I am an archaeologist. I do lots of stuff on North American archaeology and environmental archaeology, including a lot of work with big game hunting in the Pleistocene, especially with fun things that are no longer around, like mammoths.
Great. So just for context, Dr. Mackey, because we're recording this in May, because I'm about to go to field work. You're about to go to field work. Yep. So we're stacking a couple episodes. And so before you, we've had three tribal guests on, Ponca, Lakota, and Pawnee. And we've also had Dr. Alexander Crabe, who will be actually, his show will be coming out on the 15th of this month, talking about Om Rock Shelter. So we've talked a lot about recently, these past couple episodes, mostly about historic preservation, tribal historic preservation and NAGPRA compliance, especially what's going on in the context of the federal government. So really excited to have you come on and talk more intrinsically about a topic that many folks are fascinated about, and that is the big hairy elephants that used to walk around the North American Great Plains, or as, who was it, Meltzer described it as the American Savannah?
Yeah. I think it was Meltzer.
The American Serengeti, yeah.
Serengeti, yes.
Yeah, the American Serengeti is what I described it. So briefly, what is a mammoth kill site and why are they so important?
So I think one of the reasons why I think a lot of us are fascinated by the fact that we know when people come into the Americas, they come in contact with all these species that we don't have anymore, right? Like mammoths and mastodons, and then there's tons of other what we call Pleistocene fauna, giant ground sloths and like giant beavers and these big other species of elephants. We also see glyptodons, like big giant armadillos, all this cool stuff that we don't have anymore on the continent. And I think it's this nice gateway into talking about how environments change and how people interact with the environment. And the other reason why there's such an interest, I think, beyond just this idea of what we would view as these minimally armed hunters taking down this large animal, is also the fact that these animals aren't around anymore. And also, when we talk about the history of people in North America, some of the earliest sites historically that we see being recorded in the American archaeological record have a projectile point at them and some of this game. Sites like Blackwater Draw, which a lot of people have probably heard of, where we get the name Clovis from, right. We have mammoth remains and a Clovis point associated with it. So I think there's historic reasons. I think there's interest reasons. There's all these reasons why people are really interested in mammoth kill sites, particularly.
Excellent. And so you've worked on a famous one, Laprell Mammoth Kill out in Wyoming, which is funny. So like I just finished up a Great Plains archaeology class at an upper level undergrad, lower level grad level. And I had a student who looked at mammoth kills and I was just giggling because all of her citations were from Wyoming folks. And she showed the Laprell Mammoth Kill. And I was just like, oh, this is awesome. This is really cool to see. And I didn't prep them at all. I just let them go. So that was really fun. So other than Laprell, how many other mammoth kill sites have you worked on or conducted research on? And what was so special about Laprell in particular?
So Laprell is really special in regards to as a site, and it's also really important for kind of a launching point for a lot of my research. Laprell, for listeners who may not be quite as familiar, it's just about 13,000-year-old site where we have a mammoth, probable kill, definite butchery, and then associated around it is this campsite where we have both Clovis and Folsom diagnostics. And it's located in eastern Wyoming. And Laprell, interestingly, we started working on the site in 2014. We just did our last field season out there in 2024. And that basically took me from a master's student or a recent master's graduate up to a professor, assistant professor now, which is pretty wild. And Leprell, and showing that Leprell was a human used mammoth, was a big part of my doctoral research. But it also launched all this other research into other mammoth sites across the country, but especially on the plains that I've been working on, to understand how many of these sites we have, how we identify what they look like, and what work needs to be done to better understand what place mammoths filled in the lifeways of people who lived in the Pleistocene. So currently I'm working on another mammoth kill site that was first recorded and excavated in the 1970s, also by Dr. George Frizen, in Wyoming, the Colby Mammoth site, which is located in the northern part of the state. But unlike Leprell, which has one mammoth at it, Colby has seven mammoths at it. So it's a very different type of site, but we're still seeing kind of use of these animals and hunting of them. And when we're trying to understand their place in lifeways in the Ice Age, it's really important to understand from a bunch of different sites.
Excellent. So other than Colby, which is like also a fascinating spot in Leprell, like what are some other notable mammoth kill sites in the Great Plains?
So there's definitely a number of them. So what is considered a mammoth or mastodon, or let's just say like an elephant like species kill site in North America, is something that's been pretty hotly debated for a number of decades at this point. Most people accept about 15 of them across the continent, and a lot of those land in the plains, especially in kind of the like along kind of the front range of the Rockies. So we have Colby, Leprell, we have Dent, which is in northern Colorado. We have Blackwater Draw, which is down in New Mexico. Further east, we have Kimswick and Lang Ferguson. We also, down in the southwest in the San Pedro Valley, we have a number of sites, including Laner and Murray Springs. And then we even have a site, El Fin del Mundo, down in the Sonoran Desert, south of the U.S. border.
What about the Lovewell Reservoir mammoth?
Yeah, there's also, so this also brings up, there's a bunch of other mammoth sites beyond those 15 that are widely accepted that have been proposed as being mammoth kill or butchery sites, including Lovewell that is mentioned, La Sena. There's a bunch of others all throughout. And a lot of these aren't discussed as much for various reasons, or they're not on that widely accepted list. It can be everything from they're not well reported to maybe what they have there, other people don't agree, hits the bar for a definite human use of those animals. And there's lots of discussion about what evidence do we have at what sites and what can that tell us about their place. So I think the number, this is one of the things I was working on for my dissertation. So while I've worked on site at Leprell and Colby, I've also pulled together pretty continent ranging wide lists of what sites are discussed. And it's something like, if we just talk about the sites that say there are lithic artifacts, a stone tool artifacts at them, we have about 15 widely accepted, but more than 70 have been proposed across the continent. If we also look at sites that have other lines of evidence, things like bone breakage patterns or bone distribution patterns, that list gets much longer as well. So there's a lot of work actually to be done on this mammoth hunting thing that archaeologists at least have been interested in for well over 100 years at this point.
Absolutely. So we have, you said, like roughly 15 definitely confirmed, definitely mammoth kills. And then we have roughly 55 more that are potential or been postulated. So what kinds of tools, features, and patterns do archaeologists find when it comes to a mammoth kill site, a confirmed mammoth kill
site? Confirmed mammoth kill site. So this is a great thing. And I should say the number that I pull out, 15, the people that most often are cited for this are one person we've already mentioned, Dave Meltzer, and then also work by Don Grayson. They put out a paper, actually a series of papers over the last couple decades that kind of look at a lot of these proposed sites. And it comes down to a couple dynamics. Most of the time we talk about them as three different things. So this includes contemporaneity of human and the animal. So there's human-made artifacts and an animal at the same time, right? That there's some association between those two things, that they're at the same time and they're connected to each other. And then oftentimes that there is some indication of use. So that can be butchery marks, stone tools, any kind of indicate breakage patterns, any indications that people use them. Now, often the marker that people are really looking for is a projectile point. Right? Just like we see in all time periods across all of archaeology, everybody loves the sharp points. This is definitely true. We talk about mammoth kill sites as well. And so that's really the thing that often you know, is one of the smoking gun, for lack of a better term, about some of these sites. But there's some really interesting questions to ask about what other tools we should expect to be there. And this is actually one of the things that Laprelle made me start looking at when we first went back to Laprelle in 2014. We didn't have a projectile point. We only had a really small tool assemblage, one flake tool, so pocket knife of the past, and then a bunch of little teeny tiny pieces of flakes from sharpening stone tools. And there had been some questions raised if those were associated, and those were very fair questions with how much of the site had been excavated and what had been reported. So we went back to look. And one of the things that I've been pulling together with a lot of these sites is not only what is the tool assemblage that's there, but how was it excavated? Because if what we should expect to find at these sites, which does seem to be the case at a lot of the accepted sites where it's a couple stone tools and maybe less than 100 flakes, most of them under a half inch big, a few centimeters at most, if you're not doing certain things in how you're excavating the site, it's going to be really easy to miss, right? So if you're not screening, if you're only testing a really small area, it's going to be really easy to miss those artifacts. And so instead of thinking a site isn't, for sure is not a kill site, maybe we should be treating it as more of a question mark, right? Or going back to those records and seeing if we can figure out more about the human presence at that site.
Absolutely. And so when it comes to projectile points that you expect to see at a confirmed mammoth kill, like what's the type that you're really looking at? Like that, yeah, the type, the kind of projectile point.
The classic is definitely Clovis, right? At these sites, we tend, Clovis is the archaeological culture that we associate with proboscidian hunting way back from that discovery at Blackwater Draw, which was shortly, technically the discovery at Dent was slightly before Blackwater, wasn't publicized till after. Saw that pattern a lot with some of these site discoveries. And that's the typical thought. And then especially on the plains, what we see is very shortly, maybe overlap, potentially overlapping with that, we see the appearance of fulsum points. And those are much more strongly associated with bison remains. But there's been some recent work on timing, what the timing is of Clovis and fulsum. Is there potential for overlap between those? But traditionally, we definitely talk about proboscidian hunting as being this Clovis thing. Now, that being said, there's also proboscidian sites out there that are older than Clovis that have been proposed. And then there's some sites where we don't have diagnostics at them. So we assume that they're associated with Clovis until we have that diagnostic. The best we can do and say the timing overlaps.
Absolutely. What is a proboscidian? Proboscidian? You mentioned it a couple times.
Yeah, it's out of habit. Sorry, I should have introduced that first. Proboscidian refers to the taxonomic classifications that elephants and mammoths and other related animals like mastodons, etc., all land in. So when I use that term, it's because it means like some of those 15 sites, they're not all mammoth sites. Some of them have mastodons at them. One of them has a gonfather, which is like a cool, slightly more southern, slightly more tropical elephant species that occurs in North America. So proboscideans is the catch-all for those.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, we're going to go ahead and take our break right there. We'll be right back with Dr. Madeline Mackey. Stay tuned. And welcome back to episode 24. So real quick, Dr. Mackey, what do mammoth kill sites tell us about paleo-indigenous lifeways?
So I think the classic interpretation that we have, especially when we talk about Clovis, but we can also talk about populations across North America especially, is that this view of them as megafauna specialists who really center their lifeways around hunting these animals, which has implications for when you think about even today about what you eat and like how that structures your time. There's certainly something to that, right? Like we all structure our time around going to the grocery store or making money to buy things at the grocery store. Or maybe you're someone who like decides to save yourself time by doing like a meal service. Or if you're like real fancy, which none of the archaeologists are, you can hire a chef, right? But like that, like what you eat plays a lot into lots of other things. And this idea of Clovis as megafauna specialist, that would have implications for how often they move their houses and how far they move their houses and where they set up camp and what daily activities are and who is doing what tasks in camp and all of these different things. So understanding the place of something like proboscideans, or we can talk about other big game, especially Pleistocene big game, has really big implications for what people are doing day to day. Right now, the original interpretation, because we have things like the discovery of Blackwater Draw with Clovis Point right next to a mammoth remain, was that everyone was, it was all about mammoths and other elephant species and big game and all this hunting, hoorah. But that has also come under question with reinterpretations of existing sites and new discoveries at different sites that small game, plants, et cetera, other materials were also really important in the diet, potentially more important, which would change some of our understanding of what people are doing. So while it seems like a kind of simple question of what is the place of proboscideans in Pleistocene lifeways, it has really big implications for what day-to-day life looks like 13,000 years ago across North America in the Ice Age. If these are centerpieces of life, we should expect to see lots of these mammoth kill sites. It should be a really common site. And understanding how we identify them would be really important to telling that. If it's what only happens once in a lifetime, it's a thing you talk about forever, that could is going to have a very different archaeological signature. So that's one of the things that kind of it really interests me about it, is what is the place of mammoths and mastodons and big game in the food system for people who were living here 13,000 years ago. I don't think anyone truly thinks that they were only eating meat, right? That's a little bit of a straw man we set up so we can argue at each other as academics. But understanding if it is something that's happening pretty frequently versus only once every few years or a couple times in a lifetime, those are very different ways of kind of structuring what you're doing and how you live your life.
Absolutely. And so I know a year or two ago, there was a paper that postulated that came out, I think from Kent State, that postulated that Clovis points in particular weren't actually used to hunt mammoths, and that they were like knives and not projectile points. And that mammoths, I think they said that mammoths therefore were scavenged and not actively hunted, but I can't remember if that's what their paper said or.
They definitely, I can't remember if it was only scavenging, but the argument was definitely that mammoths weren't a kind of centerpiece of right. The use of Clovis points. Yeah.
And, but like recently within the past year, a study came out on an indigenous ancestor. They said they had permission from the tribe, or the original study did, and then they used, regardless, that showed that the diet of that individual from, was it Idaho?
Montana.
Montana. Like their diet was heavily mammoth, I believe. I don't know mm-hmm. if they got it to the, like, the. I know they got it to the genus level. So my question in all that, in the context of talking about the different diets, is when it comes to these populations that are equipped with Clovis points, I refuse to call them Clovis people or the Clovis culture. I will die on that hill. People equipped with Clovis points. There's also an older theory that comes with humans were the main factor behind these Pleistocene megafauna extinctions. Like, where's the current body of literature, or where does the field of archaeology sit on the topic of megafauna extinctions now as it relates to human involvement?
Yeah. So that is the other, we can talk about reconstructing Pleistocene lifeways, but the other is these animals go extinct at the end of the Ice Age after the arrival of human populations, along with at least 30 plus other genera of species. And I think mammoths especially fill a kind of key place in this debate of what I like to call, which is off of a paper title, and I apologize, I don't remember who it was by, overkill versus overchill, which is it people that had a hand in kind of these species going away, or is it the environmental change that we see happening at the end of the Ice Age? Overkill versus overchill. And I think mammoths really end up being one of the keys to this debate because they are the animal that we find most commonly associated with clear instances of hunting. So those 15 different sites, most of those sites are mammoth. There's a couple mastodon sites in there. There's a gomphothere site, which is like a tropical elephant in North and South America. And then we also have a site that has horse and camel at it. So obviously, mammoths are the predominant species we see behind that. They're also a keystone species, meaning they're really important ecologically when we talk about the Ice Age across the Americas. And so that is this key debate that we see in overkill. Now, the original idea behind overkill, especially in the Americas that was discussed, but in other continents as well, is really attributed to Paul Martin. Basically observed that on multiple continents, as we see people appear, then lots of megafauna often go extinct, and talked about those potentially being connected, and especially that as people come in, potentially hunting could be easier. Now, there's been lots of work that has been done on overkill, not only by the archaeological community, but also by paleoecologists, which is really interesting, talking about kind of what are the circumstances behind it and what is the main cause. The impression I get in that literature is that I think many archaeologists lean towards environmental causes and many paleoecologists lean towards human causes, which is really interesting. And I pretty regularly, a few times a year, new papers come out and new analyses, and it's a really hard thing to figure out because they can weirdly leave some kind of similar signatures. I also think that there's certainly something to be said, and this is in some ways people are like, that's like the easy way out, but there probably could potentially be a hand in both, right? We know the environment is changing. We know definitely some of those genera, we don't know exactly when they go extinct of animals, which complicates it. Some of them may go extinct before people appear. But if we just talk about mammoths, definitely after people, although we do see some small mammoth populations survive on islands, especially in the Arctic, for thousands of years after the continental mammoth species go extinct, which is really interesting as a contrast. So it's definitely, I think, still a hotly debated thing and people arguing both sides. I kind of land somewhere in the middle. Like, I do think that some of these species were in an environmentally stressful position, but humans may have had a hand. Now, if it's a tap or a shove, a little harder to say, which maybe me being a little bit of a cop-out, but there's definitely something interesting about that and talking about trying to figure out those two things in a very distant time period, which is, can be a challenge.
Right. And I think most archaeologists, at least from our generation, would fall under like definitely both, but which side of the scale is heavier is the point. I don't think anyone would argue that humans didn't contribute. But were they the sole cause? I don't believe it was just like that Blitzkrieg hypothesis of these small groups of Clovis armed people coming in and just killing a keystone species. And so I think, like, I had a student in the class this year talk about, are they suggesting that humans killed 36 species? It's no, because those predators would have relied on the prey. And so, like, you just got to knock out one or two things and you do see a house of cards.
And the other thing I think especially that makes it, like, mammoths another really interesting case in talking about that is the fact that mammoths, like, it takes forever for mammoth generations. There's a reason why it takes a long time. I think gestation for elephants today is like 2 years. And then normally the calves stay with the moms for a long time after. So to have dramatic impacts to species like that is a lot easier because it's not something like a bunny that has, you know, offspring every year and many of them, right? And so they're a lot more susceptible to human hunting and environmental change on that side as well. And I do think because they're such a visible species when we talk about hunting in the Ice Age, that's one of the reasons why we talk about them as a centerpiece of that. And yeah, like you mentioned, the idea is not that humans were out there hunting all 30 whatever of those different genera. It's that if the predators don't have prey to eat because the humans have collapsed those populations, then the predators start being under stress as well. And the cascade that starts happening when you take out a species that's so key to the ecology of a region. And it's a really interesting, there's a reason why we've been talking about that debate for decades at this point as well, because in addition to being these species that we find really interesting, they're also the species really key to the ecology of those time periods. And understanding a human hand in that is something that is interesting and also feels really important for our understanding when we talk about the past. So absolutely. I will also say the other thing I think that's really interesting that I don't feel like we talk about as much is regardless of how, especially if mammoths were really important for populations during that time period, but even if mammoths aren't, which I will admit, I think they were pretty important, I think for understandable reasons with what my research questions are, like that means that we definitely know the populations were at least occasionally, if not frequently, using mammoth meat and other products, et cetera. And then those species go away on the landscape. How do people respond to that? Right? That's another thing that is like, regardless, these are species that are important to populations at those time periods, and then they're not there anymore. So how do humans respond to that? And how do humans respond to that faunal community change that's also being coordinated with environmental change that we see going on, and human response to environmental shifts is another really important question that I think sometimes gets lost in the shuffle when we just focus on something going extinct.
And it seems once the mammoths are gone and those large herbivores, like bison, just take off, like just absolutely overfill that gap. And with the climate changing, they become wildly successful. And then we see humans adapting to 10,000 years of bison specialization of hunting.
Yeah. You know? And it's also really interesting because that tells us, that potentially tells us something about the importance of large game in those, especially on the plains. I think there's also some interesting dynamics to be talked about continentally, in that we often, especially in the fluted time periods, we tend to talk about archaeology like it's continental, but there is regional variation that goes on, especially as you see things like Folsom and then a lot of the stemmed components that we have on the plains. Like, it gets more and more regionalized as they're changing different animal community and hunting styles. You head into bison, but there's various bison species as well that are going on. And there's a lot of really interesting dynamics there that I think we really don't explore as often as maybe we should for kind of understanding what life was like.
Yeah, I mean, think like the archaic period in the Great Plains is just so whole, like no one looks at it.
No.
That's become such a huge gap. That's such a pivotal period. We go from hunting, the way the region works is you have the people studying mammoth kills, and then you have the farmers. And then there's 11,000 years of time that no one looks at in between. And we're just like, people are still around, but it's just like on the plains, people are just so, it's either the elephants or the corn.
Yeah. And I'm like terribly guilty of that. And it's something I think about a lot. And at some point I'm like, I'm going to work on that. And I hope I do.
I keep telling my students, I'm like, there is a wide open field for you to become an archaic period Great Plains archaeologist. Like, you could do whatever you want and no one's there to tell you're wrong.
No, and that's actually true in a lot of regions across North America, in that the middle, after you get into the Holocene, there's just way less people researching that early Holocene time period. And there's a lot of really interesting regionalization going on and like changes in ecological community stuff and like different cultural materials appearing and like all this cool stuff to be done, but there's not a lot of people doing it.
Fair enough. Open call for those interested in Great Plains archaeology, go to the archaic. Awesome. It was such a pleasure to have you on, Dr. Mackey. This was a lot of fun. It's always nice to be able to chat with you again about these fun topics. For our audience, where can they find you?
So the best place to find me is probably through my email. I'm a little old school. I currently am not holding a lot of social media, which I occasionally feel guilty about, but my mental health is good with it. You can find mmackey@msu.edu. My emails are open if you are interested, and please reach out. I am always happy to talk to anyone.
Excellent. Thank you so much. All right, everyone, until next time, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Take it easy. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram @Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.